Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. I don't know anything about technology. Computers are the worst, man.
You've probably built half the audio pipes we're using.
Irony. I just hate all of this.
Just say that your Skype account got hacked.
Yeah, I got Snapchatted all over my Skype.
But it only lasted for 10 seconds.
I don't even want to imagine what a Snapchat on my Skype is going to sound like.
So, Evan Dahl, most people, I'm assuming, know you from Flipboard, but how did you get started? What got you into nerdery and computery?
Let's see. I still remember the day when my mom's friend who had an educational discount showed up with an LC3 at my house and unloaded it from the car. And that was my first Mac that I had at home. I don't know. As a kid, I spent a lot of time just like screwing around with computers, basically. Using pirated copies of Photoshop and messing around with HyperCard and reading books about typography. There was this great book called The Mac Is Not a Typewriter. Does that ring a bell for either of you guys? It was all about like kerning and, you know, serif and sans serif fonts, and just like it was just, you know, kind of planted that seed of I don't know, design meeting technology. But really, I studied computer science in college, and I graduated in 2003, and at the time it was still sort of like the dot-com bubble had popped and there weren't really any jobs we had for techies anywhere. I was living on my brother's floor in Berkeley. I couldn't get a job anywhere. I applied for a job at a record store at Amoeba Records, I guess. Yeah. Not Barry and Benjamin Amoeba. So I applied for a clerk job at Amoeba Records, got rejected from that, and then somehow got a job at Apple a few months later. A friend of a friend who worked there had seen me like hacking away on my senior project at school and passed my resume to the right person. And it was one of those sort of fortuitous happenstances.
Okay, well, let's just let's spend an hour unwinding all of that.
Yeah.
You got into the Mac through design?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing some programming as a kid, but I was really interested in, I loved just messing around with graphic design. I don't know if you remember, back when the Mac clones were around, there was this great website for power computing enthusiasts called, It was like Power Central or something like that. I designed the logo for their website. It was like this, you know, like kind of cheese ball, you know, like, you know, colors and gradients and crap.
Yeah, it was the '90s.
Yeah, totally. It was the '90s. Yeah. It was such a thing.
A six tone gradient was that's what it's all about.
Yeah, that was, I spent a lot of time just messing around with that sort of stuff to no obvious end. I just enjoyed doing that sort of thing. And I really, like I said, I did some hacking around with HyperCard and stuff, but I wasn't really like programming per se until maybe the very, very end of high school. So, you know, when you read about how, you know, unless you've been programming since you were 8 years old, you're never going to make it in the software industry.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we'll get into that. Yeah. I'm sharpening, you know, my pitchfork is like, it's getting sharpened right now. So what is it about HyperCard that drew you, that sort of got you into the programming sort of thing?
Well, I mean, basically it was all to the end of being able to make cool animations. Like I remember working on my school computer lab was full of SE30s. So you were working on HyperCard in black and white, and I made this sort of like pixel art animation of like a comet crashing into the earth and everything exploding, and you know, just hacking away at that, like sketching out every single keyframe,
sure,
you know, for hours. And it was like, oh, you know, if you write a little bit of, you know, HyperScript, you can get it to, you know, when you click, it'll do something. It was all just sort of like, you know, a means to an end in terms of like, you know, cobbling together some finished product.
Kind of what Flash is like, or.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, talk about Flash or HyperCard, like neither one is going to win any awards from like, you know, fancy pants computer scientists about like right. how technologically advanced or you know, impressive the tools or the language are. But, you know, if it allows you to make things, you know, worse is almost better.
Yeah.
I'm still sort of waiting for that HyperCard moment to happen on the iPad, you know, where, you know, how, for, you know, a 10-year-old kid to be able to pull out their iPad and, you know, do some scripting and do some drawing or sketching and having something that sort of comes to life in front of them. I think there's a really,
I think so too. I've been tempted to try to make that, but I yeah. don't have the brilliant insight that it's going to take to make that leap.
Yeah. Yeah.
So somebody will steal that idea and make $1 billion and hopefully buy his dinner.
And I hope someone does. You know,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's like I saw a great riff on the whole. You know, I have an idea for a startup and I'm looking for a technical co-founder. It was, you know, I have a great idea for a novel and all I need is someone to write it.
Yeah.
Right.
What a 50.
Yeah. I'm imagining making the world's longest long jump. And
you know, right,
I'm accepting
it already. So, yeah. So if you do it, I'll sue you. But
it's my idea. So what did you do in college? You got into a bit of programming, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spent hours upon hours programming.
Are you a nerd or a design guy? Which is a stupid question because everybody's nerdy, but.
I was definitely a nerd in college. I mean, in, you know, through most of my life growing up. I mean, you should see the photos. But
no, yeah. I don't mean that. I mean that in a loving way. Obviously.
No. Yeah.
It's more for the listeners than for you. But
I think at the time that I was, you know, when I was a young kid screwing around with Photoshop, or even in college, I didn't even fully realize that design was a thing that you could. I mean, I was aware that there were designers and that design existed, but it's sort of the possibilities within design, I don't think I was fully aware of.
Right.
So yeah, I was, you know, just like computer science, you know, studying red black trees and discrete finite automata and all that sort of stuff. And you know, and I was a pretty big Apple geek. I mean, even through the dark days of the, you know, I mean, I was in college 99 to 2003. It was like, I think the first, what was it? Cheetah came out right around then. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I had a classmate who had interned at Apple and I was like, oh, like, what do you think about Mac OS X? Should I install it? And he was like, no, definitely don't.
I bit down on that hard as soon as it came out. It's Mac and Unix. You can't, you know, come on. So you got into programming through HyperCard? Is that accurate?
That was the, you know, the first lines of code that I ever wrote were in HyperCard, and then, you know, many turns of the crank later. I mean, I didn't even really do much if any Mac programming in college. Although my sort of like that final project that I was talking about, I wrote a Mac OS X email client. Because I've always sort of geeked out over email, and I wanted, this was, you know, 2002, 2003, and I wanted to have an email client that organized my emails by people, and, you know, didn't really have folders. It was more of like, it was sort of like, you know, Gmail wasn't out at this time, and it was sort mm-hmm. of like a more sort of organized around conversations and organized around, you know, the people who, it had this algorithm, you know, which was totally, you know, jury-rigged and, you know, just like, you know, largely faked out, but it was, you know, based on how often you tended to reply to people and like sort of the volume of messages times the reply rate times how often did you send attachments to each other, and it sort of gave each person like, you know, a mail rank you know, to decide whether their message should flow to the top of the heap or not.
That's great. I would actually like that right now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I'll send you some screenshots. It's funny, you know, it's these ideas, whether, you know, whether it's HyperCard itself or, you know, some of the email stuff that I've been geeking out over for a long time. It's like these ideas remain good ideas Yeah. Or, you know, maybe, or I mean, I'm not saying they're good ideas necessarily.
They're timeless.
But yeah, they're very timeless. So many.
Well, you're dealing with people, right?
Yeah. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
People don't go away.
Right. Yeah. So. The fundamental, you know, yeah, exactly. When you're hacking on email, you're hacking on human behavior.
Right. So is that sort of being the central, I don't want to say tentpole, but.
The theme of my life.
The theme, yeah. Yeah, I don't want to try to stay away. Yeah, I don't want to say the theme of your life either. Because, I mean.
That's a good question. I mean, yeah, definitely the social angle. I mean, you know, when we started building Flipboard, the central premise was that there's too many things to read in the world. There's too much incoming information for someone to make sense of. And there's even too much... There's too much high quality stuff. I mean, there's, you know, you think about all the great, like, long form, you know, sites that are out there and just all these, like, you could drown in an avalanche of great content and never get a chance to read any of it. Okay. I mean, you should see my pocket queue. I'm hoping to read that all when I retire or something. But, you know, but that if you were to start somewhere, you should start with the things that people that you know are, or, you know, when I say people that you know, I could mean real world friends. I could mean people who you follow on Twitter, who you trust, people who you just happen to share an interest with, and, you know, using that as sort of the starting point for, if I only have 10 minutes or 15 minutes to read things online today, this is where I should start.
Right.
And I guess that sort of ties back to some of the other, you know, some of the.
Well, it fits with bubbling email up to the top that you.
Yeah.
You
know. Yeah. For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after university, you got into Apple.
Yeah. I joined Apple in 2003, right around the same time as Vicky, who I know you guys had on the podcast recently.
Sure.
I spent about 3 years working in the Pro Apps division, on, you know, like Final Cut Express. I was one of the army of engineers conscripted to help out with shipping Aperture 1.0. It was one of those situations where Apple had committed to launching it at this conference, and there was no way to move it. So they're like, okay, well, we've got an engineering team of, I think they had an engineering team of like 10 or 15. Like, we'll dump on another 40 engineers from other projects, and it'll be great.
The mythical man decade.
Yeah, pretty. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pretty classic.
And, you know, when did they announce that? That was the one in Texas, right? The
it was like the something. I don't know. I don't remember.
It was like a pro photo show or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't
yeah.
like an Apple centric.
It wasn't an Apple thing. That's right. Yeah, it was like 2006, I guess.
Yeah.
That was fun. That was interesting.
So, what's it like working in the pro group, pro apps group? I guess.
You know, it was a very different group culturally from, like, you know, at the time when I was there, there was the OS group, and that was Bertrand Serlet's organization, and they did, you know, Mac OS X and all the Mac apps and all that sort of stuff. And Pro Apps was sort of like, and as well as the apps group, which makes, you know, iPhoto, iMovie, iTunes, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, iWork. There was sort of a cultural divide between those two. You know, I mean, 3 years, so I spent 3 years in Pro Apps, and then when I switched over to work on the iPhone team, you know, I still had to go through a full gauntlet of interviews. I think I interviewed with like 11 or 12 different people just to transfer within the company, into the sort of the hallowed ground of, you know, Forstall and Bertrand's organization. But, you know, it was Pro Apps was, you know, a lot of people in Pro Apps really love, you know, working on audio and video and photo. I mean, you know, these are people who used to be editors or who used to be musicians. There was this guy who I worked with. He worked on I think he still does actually, works on the some of the audio software for Final Cut. And, you know, in a past life, he was like a professional, keyboard player. Like, he played on, you know, like Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell. And
really?
That's
pretty awesome. That's
keyboard rocker, yeah. With like long flowing hair. Yeah. But it was a fun place to cut my teeth. And I was working on video software. I didn't really know anything about video, but I was able to sort of, you know, take, I was able to bring my sort of perspective as a software generalist. And
Was that a nice place to land, given your sort of more creative?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't want to say creative, but the design-centric upbringing,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
There was a little bit of that. It was also just like, I've read that, every software engineer has a certain number of lines of bad code that they have to write. You have to get them out of your system, and then you can finally start doing good work. And I definitely wrote a lot of bad code there. I mean, there was a project that I worked on which never saw the light of day. It was sort of like this experimental video editing app that we just we hacked away on it for probably close to a year and wrote mountains of code and then threw it all away. And it was just like, I mean, number one, gave me an opportunity to learn by doing and just like make a lot of mistakes. And then also learning that your ego shouldn't be attached too tightly to the code, right? Because like the code, you should always be willing to delete. The product is okay, I think, to have some irrational emotional attachment to, but like the code is not, not something that you're going to be dragging around behind you forever and, to some benefit.
Well, if you could get the product without the code, you're winning.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, code. Code is a liability because you have to maintain it, and other people have to understand it. It's only, and it's only offset by the utility that it provides.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If I could wave a wand and make everything I wanted, I would do it in a second.
Yeah.
As much as I enjoy code, I'd code for fun, but
It does though. To go off on a slight tangent, it's been interesting at Flipboard. We've engineers who care about design and like to prototype, and we have designers who sometimes write some code. And we've experimented with, there have been times, especially earlier on in the company, where the designers and the engineers were like shoulder to shoulder, like building the very, very early prototype of something and sort of seeing what was unfolding on the screen. And as we've tried to, scale and sort of parallelize, there have been features or projects where we've said, okay, like let's let the designers, they know how to, build a prototype. We don't necessarily need the scarce resource of an engineer, writing some throwaway code just to prototype something. The problem with that is that, so the designer comes up with the idea and maybe fleshes it out using some, CSS animation framework or Quartz Composer or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then they come to the engineer, and the engineer's like, the engineer isn't as emotionally invested in it, or they haven't, because you didn't spend that scarce resource prototyping. It's like, it's somehow, you could do 70, 80 prototypes of different ideas, and they all sort of seem that's okay. And you haven't been forced up front to like choose to commit to, okay, I'm going to like write some code and devote it to this thing. I don't know. Sometimes having a constraint or removing constraints isn't always necessarily, liberating on a creative side.
Is that a constraints thing, or is that sort of an emotional ownership thing? Like if the designer and the engineer had been in there. So as I write code, and if you gave me a spec, I'm not as invested in it as if we'd been sitting together coming up with the idea in the first place.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely true. I mean, it's an emotional investment thing, but I think it's also when you're forced up front to say, we're not gonna prototype all 10 potential animations for this thing. Like if you say, let's prototype all 10 and just have the designer do it, then they come back and you've got all 10, and they all sort of feel like you haven't been forced up until that point to edit, to say,
Well, when the limits are what you can do in like motion or Quartz Composer or whatever, those aren't the limits that you're going to face when actually implementing it.
That's absolutely true as well. Yeah.
And that's as much of a canvas as the size of the screen. When you're designing stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I'm definitely, when I wish upon a star, I wish that, I know that there are some homebrewed tools at Apple that are for UI prototyping that are core animation based, which, it allows the developer and the engineer to speak much more the same language when it comes to, things like the animation curves and just like the language of layers and
especially with the new physics stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, because otherwise, yeah, I mean, totally, we've had, you know, we toyed around with having a designer, a contractor who was, you know, this really great motion graphics expert who, you know, could do anything in After Effects, but the impedance mismatch was too high between that and and the actual thing that we were building.
Yeah. I mean, unless you can take that, you know, the After Effects recipe or the motion recipe and sort of feed it or at least interpret it as core animation stuff, you're kind of wasting your time.
Yeah, totally.
Let's rewind a bit. Because I do want to talk about this, but, you know, I want to keep all the listeners on the edge of the seat.
Yeah. Maximum dramatic impact.
We got to spend like 3 or 4 hours, you know, just building up to talking about Flipboard.
Right. It's going to be like The Hobbit. We can do it in three hour segments.
Exactly. Right. You don't know it, but you're being recorded in 48 frames per second right now. So after the Pro apps, you got into the iPhone group. What year was that?
So that was January of 2007. So just
before the launch.
It was actually it was like 1 to 2 weeks after the announcement at PacWorld.
Right. Yeah.
So I was sitting there.
Is that the first you'd heard of the project?
There was definitely buzz within the company. Sure. That like where have all these, you know, some of the best engineers have been spirited away and
it vanished into a dark room. And,
totally. You know, people knew something was up. You know, it's certainly like the software, like no one had seen what the UI looked like. That was held so closely. So a couple of weeks after I knew once it was announced, I knew one of the managers who was working on the iPhone, what was the iPhone team. Mm-hmm. And I pinged him and, you know, a bunch of interviews later, I joined the team. At that point, I think it was maybe like 20 to 30 people on the, you know, maybe 20, 25 people on like the core apps and like framework. You know, I think there was literally one guy working on UIKit at that time. I was brought in, I worked on the clock app. I worked on SMS, helped out a little bit on photos. I worked on mail. Mail was the main thing actually that I was brought in to work on, which I was pretty stoked about. And then, you know, quickly I realized that my like highfalutin ideas about, you know, reinventing email, like, There was a to-do list, you know, like the length of my arm of just like the basic features of a mail app that needed to be implemented.
Email is such a dog to,
There's just so many baseline requirements. I mean, unless you're willing to go in and say, you know what, we're not going to support 90% of the core. It's like, you know, it's like building a Microsoft Office killer.
Unless you're going to make Gmail.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I'm surprised there's so many like Sparrow-esque or, you know, other new email clients that are coming out. Because it is such a beast to implement. Like, well, IMAP is insane.
Totally. I mean, and there's all these different bugs you've got to work around with the servers. Yeah. And I mean, what's interesting about what Gmail has brought is that you can build an app like Sparrow, and Sparrow was just a Gmail client. So they didn't have any quirks, or you know, at least initially it was. I think maybe later they added generic IMAP, but you know, you just had to, like, it's massively simplified. It's almost like the difference between writing an app that is compatible with, you know, iOS, you know, UIKit APIs, you know, from 2.0 to 7.0, mm-hmm. with all the like bugs in between, versus targeting just a single deployment version, right? Or single just targeting iOS 7. And, you know, if you're just targeting Gmail servers, then you don't have to deal with all these like crazy quirks, and there's, you know, a cleaner API to talk to.
Yeah. And you got a, you know, pretty broad target. So, how was shipping when it was iOS 1.0?
iOS
1.0.
Yeah. That's, you know, there was lots of, you know, if Macworld demo, do this. It was, you know, for me professionally looking back, I mean, it's just one of those moments where you'll never really forget being on a team like that.
That's a huge sort of expand, like that shipped or it got more attention than probably any software in the past 10 years.
Milestone in the history of computing.
Yeah. So that's a big thing to jump into, like kind of near the end and then from...
Right. To still be able to say, oh yeah, I was on the team that shipped the first
version.
Well,
no. Yes, A, that's awesome. But B,
there were people who were on the team for 2 years before that, and I was kind of in there for the last 6 months. But
yeah, but you also hadn't. It's. I'm imagining that was the first really big release of your career.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd worked on. You know, there were boxes of Final Cut Pro sitting on the shelf that I could point and show to my mom and
that's
say,
cool.
"Okay,
it's always cool to have a box. The box is it's the best thing."
But
it's the only way to explain to real people. It's like, no, I did that. It's a box.
We joked at Flipboard that we need to come out with a box something just to just have a box.
I'd buy it.
But it was a really special thing to be a part of, and. Yeah. You know, I think everyone involved knew that it was sort of one of those once in a lifetime sort of things.
Right.
It also sounds interesting because a lot of companies would just throw hundreds of people at it doing small little tiny pieces. But when you hear these stories, there's one guy doing the keyboard, one guy doing the photo app, one guy doing the mail app. And it seems like the people doing it get to have more personal investment in it as a result of that.
Yeah. I mean, even up through iOS, or, you know, it was still called iPhone OS at the time, you know, 3.0, these teams were still really, really small. I mean, maybe on some of the bigger apps like the music app, you would have 4 or 5 people working on it. Mail, the duration of the time that I was on it was never more than 3 or 4 people. You know, I mean, I joined that team and a week later they were like, here you go, you get the clock app. Like someone else has been working on it, but the alarms don't really work. Yeah. And go and, you know, like, and just hack away on it.
Make it ring.
Don't work.
Basically, yeah.
Hey, so did you screw up the time zone thing?
No.
Okay.
That's funny. Given our scheduling snafu, it would have been
tie-in
if I had screwed up the time zone. No, fortunately, that was after my time. I think that shows the dangers of rewriting, you know, or refactoring, you know, to adopt whatever new API. I think that was the glitch. There was some hot new API
they changed the NS date or an NS calendar date. No, yeah, it got out. Yeah. Just, I'm not making fun of you. I did, when I was working at Rogue Amoeba, we did, an app called Radio Shift, which is effectively TiVo for internet radio.
Yep.
And holy crap, was it a pain in the ass doing the calendaring stuff. Like you'd have to schedule everything. Oh my God. Yeah. So many weird little bugs.
You know, the hardest problems in computer science, you know, are, you know, caching and off by one errors and that sort of thing. But, you know, dates and times definitely ought to be up there in that pantheon.
It is shockingly hard to get that right. Yeah.
Totally.
Okay. So how long were you on was it the iPhone team, I guess, at the time? Yeah. Because now they've kind of split up, right? There's There's the UI kit group in there.
Yeah. I'm not sure how organizationally it's exactly divvied. I know that iPhone and iPad are tighter than they were.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, so I was on the iPhone team for about 3 years, the first 3 releases. Yeah. And, I was sort of technically like my manager was on the mail team, but I was sort of, mostly spending my time hacking away on UIKit. Internally when we were developing these apps, these sort of ad hoc like view controller classes I developed, and I, along with, you know, a couple of other engineers, we went and sort of generalized them and threw them into UIKit as, you know, UI view controller and UI navigation controller and that sort of thing. Which initially, like, that was one of the hardest things for like the documentation and sort of API review folks to like wrap their heads around, because there wasn't any clear parallel in AppKit. I mean, there was NS View Controller, but nobody really used NS View Controller.
Yeah, but it doesn't even fit into the responder chain.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. The View Controller in iOS is I'm gonna mark it as sort of the big leap in the, I don't know, the Cocoa sort of way of looking at the world, right? Like it's a parallel hierarchy of.
And especially on the iPhone, where you have such a small screen.
Yeah.
And I mean, you think about an app like Mail on OS X, or even Mail on the iPad, where you've got like sort of multiple things going on, and like you start to have these weird sort of like parenting and like, how do I have multiple, you know, split views and that sort of stuff. But on the iPhone, it made a lot of sense. And you know, you see the same thing on Android with activities, and
right.
there's just like this sort of unit of like, you know, I've got this app and it's got these multiple screens, and each screen is sort of a self-governing entity. Right.
I mean, otherwise you'd have a giant app controller with like states per screen kind of thing, which is crazy.
No, you can still have a giant app controller if you want to, but the app delegate for mail on iOS, at least back, you know, this is now like 2009, but that was a beast. That was like many, 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 many thousands of lines of code that,
I mean, a bunch of the teams had their own table views at that point, right?
I think table views were largely shared, but there were definitely other things that were done over and over. And I mean, I think people like to imagine that like if the product is, you know, is visually beautiful and is successful in the marketplace, then the code must be pristine. But like there was as much hacking and just like, oh my God, this is so hideous. But we're going to ship it anyway just because it works. You know, there's plenty of that at Apple, and it's, I think it's just a reality of making real world shipping.
Exactly. Yeah.
Got to do what you got to do. I mean, especially when we were working on iOS 3 and all these people had done these weirdo like hacks to, you know, pull navigation buttons out of navigation bars and like doing weird things to UIKit components. And the directive was that for a certain class of apps, don't break them. So even if they were doing something kind of hideous, you know, do your utmost to preserve that functionality. So there's all this code in UIKit that's like, you know, if application linked on or after iOS 3.0 or 4.0 or 5.0, then do the new behavior, and otherwise keep going through the old code path, which
I think that's not appreciated
by developers.
There's so much work, and it makes the code so much uglier.
On my side as a third-party developer now, that sort of unpredictability that can come from, you know, all of a sudden you start linking, you know, against the iOS 7 SDK instead of the 6 SDK, and some new bug pops up, and you're like, okay.
So that iOS or iPhone OS 2.0 was the first public API, right?
That was the first public API.
I've heard that was a lot of work.
It was just a lot of cleanup for, making things ready for consumption by the world at large. You know, you'd have.
Right.
I mean, people saw the APIs in iOS 1.0, when, you know, Erica Sadoun and whoever like went in and class dumped and like, you know, released all the you know, sort of internal UIKit methods,
Which were close to being API names.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of it.
Kind of off, like a little bit, like,
yeah,
not quite.
You should have seen the discussions on the API review list, because it's like one of these things. You know, deciding whether it should be called UI table or UI table view, or like deciding what, especially with the view controllers, like what's some of the methods ought to be called. I mean, these epic email threads where, naming a company. I mean,
naming
a product. I mean, because there are no absolute objective rules of like what's good and what's not good. Everyone has their own opinion. It's the classic, the parable of the bike shed.
Right.
Everybody gets familiar with,
As soon as it gets easy, everybody wants a piece of it.
Yeah, exactly. And naming is, you know, everyone is qualified to name things, right? So
I'm not sure if this has come up on the show before, but so Apple has an internal sort of list for API reviews where anything that's going to be made public is sort of spitballed on a giant email thread, right?
It did at the time when I was there. You know, this is back, you know, in the sort of 2007 to 2009.
Yeah, I've heard that. I believe it still happens, or at least does in certain groups.
Yeah, and as much as it can be kind of a shit show to have everyone chiming in on with their opinion. Yeah. It's also, I mean, it's the reality of, you know, you need to expose your ideas and even, you know, things like naming ideas or the concepts around classes to people who aren't emotionally invested in them, who can come at it with a neutral outsider's, like, you know, what the hell is this thing point of view.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mess, but it's a mess internally because, like, once you ship that, you know.
Can't take it back.
It's, right. It's a sanity check. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Everybody else is going to be bitching about it anyway, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you definitely want to err on the side of caution. Don't release something before it's ready. I mean, it's.
Yeah, I think Apple does really seem to adopt that philosophy where at least for one or two releases of the OS, certainly on OS 10, maybe a little less so on iOS, they will just keep stuff to themselves.
Yeah.
Until they're like, oh, yeah, this is not completely stupid. Okay, so you guys can play with it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've been running class dump on, you know, Quartz Core with, you know, Core Animation for the past several years and seeing, you know, there's this internal class called CA Mesh Transform. And I'm like, please, God.
Shh, don't tell anybody. I know. How much? Oh, my God. How much code could you rip out of Flipboard?
Out of Flipboard? I mean, we're talking probably...
It's gone.
You know, like, engineering man years of effort to. So, I mean, all the predictive, you know, snapshotting they have to do to make the flip work.
Sort of, and they've got stuff like that on on OS 10 too.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, I see the rationale behind trying to get it right. I mean, we've seen in cases where they haven't. I mean, there's been some churn. I want to say even in I don't recall a specific method, but like in the view controller classes, there were a couple methods that they like added in iOS maybe 5, and then they immediately deprecated them in 6, or maybe it was 6 and then 7. And when that happens, you're like, oh man, Apple, you know, they're not on their game. Like they immediately deprecated an API in the next release, and you know, so when that happens, there's a downside to that too.
I agree. On the other hand, if they deprecate something quickly, I kind of feel a little bit good about it in that they're like, okay, well, we didn't chase that for 10 years. We're going to fix that.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most interesting things for me, having now been exposed to Android a little bit, I'm not doing Android coding really. I mean, I know enough to be just to sort of like run the app and like debug it on a device, but like I'm not writing code on Android. But one thing that has been interesting to see on Android is that there's this, it's called this compatibility library, which you can choose to bundle with your app. And it's the equivalent of, like, you know, right now, say iOS developers who are targeting iOS 5, 6, and 7, as we are, you know, there are certain things that you just can't use on iOS 5, certain APIs that aren't there. And so you're hacking around them, you're having features that are conditionally available or not available. And how nice would it be to, like, bundle a little, you know, UI kit stub of, like, you know, the classes and methods that were missing on 5 that, that runs with your app when it's running on an older system version. I don't know if I explained that very well, but you know, basically allowing you to treat every running device as though it's on iOS 7 from an API standpoint.
Yeah, it's effectively a third-party backport of new features.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Apple would hate that.
I'm sure they would. Yeah, I mean, I mean, there are plenty of reasons, and I think probably justifiable reasons why Apple doesn't do something like that. That being said, from a developer standpoint, it is pretty damn handy.
Yeah. So I want to get into that. So you 3 years with the office
Flipboard? Group? Yeah. Let's see. We launched July of 2010. So yeah, three and a half years. I left Apple a year before that. So I left in the summer of 2009. So I've been.
And did you spend that year getting Flipboard as a company, as an entity, up to speed, or did you?
Pretty much. I mean, I left Apple. I met this guy Mike, who I started Flipboard with, and at the time we didn't really know what we were going to do. I mean, this is, you know, if it hadn't worked out, it would have been the epitome of stupidity, like walking away from Apple and, you know, whatever, you know. You know, reasons to stay at Apple, but we were initially thinking about maybe building an iPhone photo sharing app, which I'm sure would have gone over big, or maybe not. Somewhere on that spectrum between Instagram and Color.
Color, you could eat.
We toyed around with this augmented reality idea for a little bit. And then we sort of settled on, okay, we need to solve, you know, Mike had worked at Netscape in the past, and we sort of settled on the theme of like, okay, we need to like, what would a browser look like if you threw away everything that you knew about web browsers and sort of mixed in what we now know about, you know, the importance of, you know, social signals and design. And
so that's interesting. You started with the browser notion rather than we're going to be a better RSS reader, or at least a new take on RSS.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely. I mean, there were a lot. We were sort of like, it was like this concentric, you know, spiral around this idea, which I, you know, we're still spiraling. But that was definitely one of the lenses through which we looked at the problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other one was, and the story that Mike likes to tell is that he was sitting on a plane, like reading, you know, National Geographic magazine, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, you see it in print and it's so beautiful and it treats the content so well, and you see an ad and the ad gets its own page and the ad has room to be beautiful and it's like designed by Don Draper on Mad Men or whatever, and then you flip the page and it's not there anymore. And meanwhile, on the web, you've got these ads and content that are always sort of, you know, competing with each other, and like there's this sort of zero sum game in terms of screen real estate and banners and like the little ads that follow you up and down the page. And, you know, it's that was sort of, you know, trying to figure out how to magazineify online content was another one of the big themes that was pushing us as we were building Flipboard. But
so
then again,
Was the notion that you wanted to make a magazine out of the things that you read recently or regularly? I mean, or was it like
the initial?
Let's take like, because did you build initially on RSS? I don't.
So initially, I've got a let's see, paging some memory out of my hard drive. So the very earliest versions. Let me think. I don't even think there was RSS really integrated. It was pretty much just social networks, which now, I mean, now you read Flipboard and there's content from RSS. There's content from third-party social networks. There's content from Flipboard users who are creating, you know, magazines about Topic X, and they're just going out and finding stuff on the web and putting it into Flipboard. But yeah, initially it was basically just Twitter and Facebook. Okay. So if you were reading the news section on Flipboard, I think at the time that we launched, and this has changed a lot since then, but at the time that we launched, it was basically just a Twitter list of like, you know, four or five different sources.
I'm paging too, but yeah, because I think that's it's a great sort of an interesting insight of Flipboard was that it sort of eschewed the previous ways of doing that, which is like you'd subscribe to RSS feeds or you'd,
which, I mean,
it was this weird aggregated thing that, I don't know, it was new. It was new in its approach, and I think it served you well. Yeah.
It was really oriented around, you know, RSS is great for sources that you already know about, that you already think are interesting, and you're like, yes, I want to read every single article that iMore publishes, no matter what. Tell me what, you know, just shove them into my inbox. And then there's the sources that you don't know about yet, that you don't even, you know, topics that you didn't even realize existed. You care about too. I mean, you get an issue of, you know, I like to read the New Yorker, and the New Yorker shows up and they've got an article about, you know, farming, you know, salmon or something. And it's not like I went in and typed in, okay, I have an interest in farming salmon.
Yeah.
But, you know, if a trusted source says, hey, this is worth reading about, then you read about it.
Yep, I've spent way too much time reading about beekeeping or like
rooftop
farming just because a friend is like, hey, check this out. You
know? Right. The disappearing honeybee population.
Well, that was one of my big fears, was that initially maybe because of the internet, maybe just because of programming in general, that I'd be getting increasingly smaller concentric rings of content. I would only see stuff that I already knew about or people with similar interests. But I find it's the opposite, that it's finding things I would not have even thought about otherwise.
Yeah. You know, people talk about, there's this, you know, say what you want about TED Talks and all the sort of the fluff associated with them, but there's a great TED Talk, I think it's a TED Talk, about the filter bubble, and talking about how, you know, in a naive world where, you know, if you're a Democrat and you only click on, you know, Democrat democratically oriented articles, and that, and eventually that's all you get. Or if you're a Republican, you end up in this like little echo chamber of just the things that you already sort of knew about and liked, and that's not a really great world for us all to live in.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, whatever. I don't want to get into it. Think progress is it just can drive you nuts because, come on. And I'm super progressive. But anyway, whatever. I don't want to get into it.
Anytime you feel like someone's not being totally intellectually on the up and up.
Exactly.
Whichever side they're on.
Yeah. So what? Okay, so it took you what, like a year to get Flipboard out?
Yeah,
It
was, I want to say, of that year between, you know, from the time when I left Apple to when we launched the first version, which was almost exactly a year.
You quit with the idea of like, okay, I'm done and I'm going to go do something else, rather than I've got an amazing idea for an app. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay. I mean, I quit with the thinking of, you know, I've got a savings account that I can draw down for a little while. And, you know, I don't really have any huge financial obligations yet.
Did you want to work on stuff for the platform that Apple wouldn't necessarily chase? And I don't mean that in a bad way.
No.
I mean that in a way with, like, you know, Apple's never going to do a first person shooter, let's say. Yeah.
I was pretty, I don't know. I think I was kind of agnostic about that. I mean, I certainly, you know, when I was at Apple, I was like, oh, I really want a location-based to-do app. And I pitched it to people at Apple, and they're like, oh, I know. No, we're not going to ship it. And, you know, I guess I could have gone off and built something like that right away. But, I mean, you know, initially we were thinking an iPhone app for the photo sharing thing. And then eventually when we came around to the idea of what would become Flipboard, initially we were building it as a web application. It was going to be a website that you went to, and there would be this, like, sort of, you know, sort of a full page infographic style. So our designer, who we ended up finding and hiring and working with, this awesome, his name is Marcos Westcamp. What we came across that made us just like our eyes bug out. We're like, holy crap, we've got to work with this person. He'd created this website called Newsmap. It's still up. If you go to newsmap.jp, and it's this like color-coded infographic of everything that's on Google News, sorted by number of related stories that are on Google News about a given topic. And it's like, at a single glance, you can see what's happening in the world, what's important, what's new, and like what the different topic areas are. But yeah, I mean, so we were thinking about a web app, and it wasn't really, I mean, it was basically like January. So, you know, now at this point, 6 months before we shipped, we had a team of like five, a couple of, you know, one front end web guy, one back end engineer, a designer, a product manager, myself, and Mike, I think, was the team. And,
did you guys get some kind of funding?
Yeah. So we right around that time, Mike was fortunate to, his previous company had sold to Microsoft. He had a little bit of seed money that he could kick in. And then I think around, February, January, February, we raised a little bit of money. So at that point, you know, we were able to sustain a team of like probably less than 10 people, something like that, five people, something like that. And the iPad was announced, and I still remember the moment, like sitting in our little converted, you know, garage where, because every startup has to start up in a garage. Where it was actually our back end engineer, this guy Greg, he said, have we ever thought about just like coming out with the first version of Flipboard for the iPad? And it sounded like this kind of ridiculous, like extremely risky, you know, like, is anyone actually going to buy this thing? Are we really going to stake the whole company on this? And then in retrospect, it seemed completely obvious. And it's like, oh, you know, why wouldn't
you? It was tough at the time. Did you know the iPad was coming?
You know,
you can say that you don't want to say.
Well, no, I mean, you know, I do sort of at some level have a fear of, like, you know, the hand of Steve Jobs reaching up from the grave to strike.
I think
it down.
It's widely known now that they were at least started the iPad before the iPhone. So it's, but not.
There were various projects similar to the iPad that were started and then stopped. I mean, there were, you know, those code names, like the little, like the letter and like the two numbers that are often attached to Apple projects. And there were bunches of code names that had been attached to a tablet project that had gone away. So, you know, I was sort of, if you had asked me in like, you know, the month before the iPad was announced, like, is there going to be one? I would probably have said, oh, there are probably people working on it, but I don't know when it's going to come out. I mean, even back in 2006, that torpedoed video editing project that I was working on, one of the things that we had, you know, this early prototype of a multi-touch hardware surface that, you know, we were messing around with, like, oh, how could you edit video using this thing? And nothing like it has, you know, so much stuff gets left on the cutting room floor and doesn't actually ship.
I know even after the iPad announcement, a bunch of people, maybe we'll cut this, but weren't entirely sure that it would be a huge hit.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, nobody...
It was a bit of a gamble of a product.
Yeah. I mean, people were making fun of the name. They were saying, oh, it's just a big iPod Touch. And I think even now, even at this point, several years later, I still don't think we fully know what the downstream impact of the iPad is.
I mean, honestly, until I saw one, I was not sold. The announcement was like, oh, that's cool. But it was a little bit understated. But I got the opportunity to see one. And I was like, okay, that is kind of magical. It's a whole new thing, right? Yeah. So why did you bet the company on the iPad?
I wish I could say that there was some rational, you know, we saw this thing that no one else saw thing going on there. But really, it was a combination of sort of instinct and dumb luck. And, you know, there was a certain degree of like, hey, you know, we have Evan on the team and he knows how to, you know, presumably this thing is going to use those same APIs. And it's, you know, so that was definitely part of it. I mean, we weren't that the web thing that we had been working on was really just a prototype. And we still haven't really fully Flipboard doesn't fully exist on the web as, you know, as maybe it should and as, you know, maybe it will down the road. But I don't know. It just felt right. We, you know, so there were people, so after the announcement, I think, you know, teams and companies got iPads that were famously, you know, padlocked or, you know, chained to desks.
We were just working
in the simulator the whole time, like leading up to the, you know, the launch. And we like ran out.
Oh yeah. You guys didn't get a prototype? I guess. Yeah.
And, I mean,
you hadn't made a splash yet, right?
We were yet. Yeah. But then, and so pretty much from the time of the iPad's announcement to July, and you know, the iPad came out in what, April, May, something like that.
Yeah.
We were just cranking full steam ahead on the iPad version of the Flipboard. So at that point it was myself and one other iOS engineer, this guy Troy, who now actually leads our iOS engineering team, and a couple people on the back end. And it was still a pretty small team at that point.
What were the key considerations going into the 1.0 release? Like, what did you want to nail?
There were some...
I know it's a hard question to ask.
It's a good question. It's open-ended. I mean, one of the non-concrete things that we wanted to nail, Mike, our CEO, who's like this insanely charismatic, you know, he could, you know, I mean, talk about, you know, he could sell, you know, ice water to Eskimos. He could, you know, convince you to go, you know, just, one of his things was he wanted to be able to demo this thing to a room full of people and have there be an audible gasp of amazement as they saw it. That would, you know,
that's cool. That's a good
goal. Very, you know, not that concrete, but, there was a sense that we wanted to build something that was like, you know, that could be a reason for someone to buy an iPad.
Mm-hmm. Audacious. Which,
Yeah. And it's, you know, whether or not that sort of thing works out when you're shooting for it, I mean, you'll at least have fun in the process and feel like you're not just like, you know, hacking away on something really, really predictable. I mean, honestly, we were just trying to balance between perfection and shipping. And that's been, I think, something that we've been fairly good at throughout, but you know, that I think Mike and I, you know, he's much more idealistic and brings the here's the perfect idealistic vision of what this could be. And then I come from the, you know, working at Apple, everyone looks at Apple and thinks about the design and the perfectionism and how every surface is so smooth. But really, Apple is just as much is just as much about shipping in a cutthroat, ruthless, like, we've got to get this thing out the door, no matter whatever, no matter what it takes, cut what you need to cut, ship some bugs, ship the right bugs, not cavalier, just like shipping crap. But
ship the right bugs should be a t-shirt.
Yeah, right. There's a sense that Apple sits around and perfects it, and only when it's perfect, this gleaming jewel, does it release it to the world. And really, it's like it's a race to the finish, and like all the trains kind of barely reach the station at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so that pragmatic instinct that you have to have in order to ship, you know, we've tried to balance those throughout. And that 1.0 push, you know, it was as much about just kind of frantically getting things in there and getting them wrapped up and just kind of having something that captured the bare raw vision of what the product could be in that first 1.0. And the happy medium between, you know, people talk about minimum viable products and all that, but if it's too minimal, people aren't going to be amazed by it. They're not going to fall in love with it, right? So it can't be so minimal. I mean, maybe it's easier to do on the web where you can just like every day, every hour, you're pushing out, you know, updates and new versions. Mm-hmm. But especially for, you know, the App Store world, like it's got to be
minimal, delightful product.
Yeah, minimal, delightful product.
Yeah, I think you sort of put the finger on it there, where I like the idea of a minimal viable product, but viable is like
very subjective. And
exactly, may as well be magic.
Yeah.
Minimal, and it's also just minimally magical product. Okay, well, yeah, I'll get on that.
Like it's, you know, yeah, like any mantra or sort of, you know, whether it's agile or extreme programming, mm-hmm, or whatever. I mean, in any of these things, like they try to make it out like, oh, the world is very simple, and all you've got to do is follow our manifesto and like ship, you know, do this one weird trick that will allow you to ship.
I think I've seen that ad.
Yeah, you lose weight, you get a bigger penis. Invariably, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, and you ship products on time. So
one weird trick.
The study is that every product and every market, I mean, it's not one size fits all, and practices that work well in some situations don't work at all in others, and you've got to know when to apply them.
Yeah. So do you guys follow any, this is a bit of a tangent, but do you follow any kind of particular methodology?
No. I mean, I like to say that we're sort of agile with a lowercase a, and I think that is even overselling the amount of process that we have. You know,
I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I think, well, especially as a startup, you have a choice to either, you're either going to be overshooting or undershooting process. And if you have to choose between those two, like you're rarely going to have exactly the right amount of process for the point that your product is at and the point that your company is at. If you've got to choose between those two, I'd rather choose to undershoot on process a little bit, because you don't want people to feel like there isn't room for them to do stupid experimental things.
Yeah.
You know, for us as a company, even though, you know, we're now 3 whatever years old, and for whatever, you know, success in the market we've had, if we act like our best ideas are behind us and all we've got to do right now is like keep people from shipping bugs and, you know, have 100% code coverage. I mean, really, what's going to torpedo us, if something torpedoes us, is going to be our own reluctance to push the envelope and do something dramatically new, or, you know, question our assumptions about what Flipboard is or what it ought to be. So, you know, when I'm talking with the engineers on the team, I say, you know, if you don't feel like you're slightly pushing the bounds of what you have permission to do from me or from anyone, then you should be right at or right past that line.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these sort of software methodology approaches, I feel that like they worked great for the team that the author was on.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, so they had like a page or two of notes of like what they did and what worked well for them. And then they had to write a 200-page book.
Right, and they padded it out
with like all the details, and then there's a, you know, sort of a cargo cult mentality where everybody just picks up on the details.
Yeah, cargo cult is exactly it. I mean, and we all like to think that our specific experiences are generalizable and universal. So my wife and I have had a couple of kids over the past couple of years, and one of the things that we found, which has been fascinating, first when we were about to have our first, everyone you know has advice. You walk down the street, and this stranger walks up and says, "You know, the one thing you've got to get the baby wipe warmer so that you have warm wipes when you're changing the diaper." It's just like
you will scar your child for life if.
And
no, you got to lock them in the basement every Friday. Friday, just locked in the basement. That's the way it's got to be.
And it's this natural human instinct to want to want first of all to help other people, and also there's this desire to like have our specific experience be generalized to every single person we know. Okay. And we found ourselves doing it with after we've had our kids, and then our friend has a kid, and we're like, oh well, you got to. It's and I think you see the exact same thing with sort of methodologies that float around in the software world. I mean, not to say there's plenty of good ideas in there. There's plenty of methodologies that have more good than harm that come from them. But like you said, if you treat it with a sort of the cargo cult mentality, it's rather agile or you aren't. I think that's a little too unnecessarily black and white.
So is this sort of this is going to get trippy, but given the insight that you can't map your experiences onto everybody else, does that sort of drive the social aspects of how you think about Flipboard?
I think so. I mean,
it's a magazine, right? But it's your magazine. It's different.
Yeah, I mean, we used to describe it as a social magazine. We now say that it's the world's best personalized magazine. And personalized can mean things come from people that you care about. They can come from our recommendations algorithms.
What drove the change in nomenclature? Was it simply a rejection of like socials overused, or was it?
It was a little bit of
realignment of your ideals.
It wasn't really a realignment. It's just like social. You know, it's sort of like any buzzword that's sort of the power behind the word starts to get diluted over time.
Mm-hmm.
We think personal says a lot of the same things without being quite so specific about how it's accomplishing that goal.
I prefer that way.
Yeah.
Social to me means not that I'm antisocial, but sometimes if I'm sitting and reading something, I don't want to be yapping about it necessarily.
Totally. Social does have some negative connotations associated with it. Like, I mean, you think about what was that social browser?
Flock.
Or Flock, yeah, totally.
Flock, yeah.
Which, are totally cool products.
Bart Dekram worked on that.
Oh, yeah.
He comes – I don't know. I've worked with Bart, and he comes up on one-third of the shows in some weird way.
Ding. Okay.
Yeah.
Debug, bingo.
Right.
And there's something that's cool about that, but it's also, if every time you're reading an article and you get the little chat heads popping up or whatever, it can be a little bit much. It's a great tool, but you don't want to be pulling it out of your tool chest over and over and over.
Right. So I don't want to be asking you to give anything away, but, what's the core of Flipboard and sort of how does that map into sort of future plans and where it's come from?
Yeah. I mean, really, I think that core of, if you just say world's best personal magazine, that's sort of like, it's like saying at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about, having the idea for the world's, what was it? World's longest long jump or something. It's, you can imbue that with, there's a lot of different ways to achieve that. And it's a problem that you can, it's sort of a mountain that you can, chip away at for a long time, years and years and years. So, I mean, really, we just look at it as getting better and better and better at satisfying that. If we're going to live up to that tagline of world's best personal magazine, what do we need to do? I mean, we need to have better and better recommendations that are personalized for you. We need to give you something that is totally essential, that isn't just like a luxury item that where you're like, oh, I've got some time to kill, I'm going to pull out Flipboard. You know, it should be something where each day you look to Flipboard for the definitive answer to what is there new in the world that I should care about. I've got limited time. I don't want to spend my entire day trolling the internet and all these different sites and all these different apps for what's new in the world. You know, serve it up to me on a silver platter.
What's worth my attention right now?
What's worth my attention right now? And especially, I mean, the time aspect, you know, none of us have any more time in our day to, you know, as the amount of content and the amount of sharing, we've seen all the charts about how right. number of posts on Facebook, a number of posts on Twitter and Instagram keep rising and rising. And it's like, we don't have any more time to spend digesting this stuff. I mean, what's so great about something that is more visual, part of why I really love Instagram is because every photo on Instagram takes the same amount of time to view, you know, leaving videos out of the equation right now. You know, it's not like some photos take 10 seconds and some photos take 10 minutes to read. There's something that's really quite nice about that. But yeah, I mean, and you know, another thing that comes to mind when I was talking about luxury versus necessity, I think that in a way, you know, the sort of iPad first launch of Flipboard and the fact that many people still think of Flipboard as being an iPad app when, you know, we have an iPhone app, we're out on Android phones and tablets, we're out on, now on Windows devices, you can flip away on your Surface. but I think tablet does imply to a lot of people more of a luxury experience than a utilitarian experience. You know, you pull out your iPad when you've got some downtime, you're getting ready for bed, or you're sitting on the couch, but your phone is like, you know, you're glued to your phone. I mean, I use my phone a lot. I mean,
constantly.
It's practically unhealthy. I mean, I've had to come up with hacks to, like, you know, I now on my phone, I do not allow myself to install any Twitter clients. and I, if I want to check, and this is why I've responded late to some of your DMs, because I only use Twitter on my phone through the web interface in Safari to sort of add a little bit of friction so that I'm not
wow.
screwing around.
Like only going to the bar across town. It sounds horrible.
Yeah, it's like, no, he only makes his own penicillin is what that's like.
Yeah, sort of techno Luddite. But what was I going to say? Yeah, I mean, so, you know, so from Flipboard's perspective, you know, if we want to be really essential, then we need to double down on the phone experience and make it even more pleasurable and fast and sort of digest everything and give me the highlights. And don't assume that I've got 10 minutes to sort of, you know, like a pig wallowing in a, you know, pool of mud. Like, I just want to, like, take a quick dip in the mud and then be on my way.
I don't know if it was intentional, but I know several people who, especially with their parents and grandparents whose iPad is their primary computer, they just put certain of their Twitter feeds or Facebook stuff in it. And it makes like a personal magazine of their lives for their parents and grandparents.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my grandmother, you know, that was her avenue to Facebook, to Instagram, was just, you know, little Flipboard tiles. And she didn't even necessarily think of herself as using those services. Yeah, I mean, really just making it an essential everyday place where you go to see what's new in the world, the things that you care about. And that comes from a lot of different places. It can be social, it can be algorithmic, it can be just like what's popular in the global trending zeitgeist. I mean, that's sometimes important too. You know, the last thing I would say is that we need to work harder at making, you think about any sort of product with to drop, you know, sort of like, I don't know what kind of lingo this is, but like, you know, network effects,
right?
You know, fax machines, you know, the whole, you know, business school case studies about how, you know, every new person who gets one of these things makes it a more valuable experience for everyone who's using it. Right. And we keep asking ourselves, you know, how does Flipboard get better, or how should Flipboard get better when there are more people reading content on it? You know, there should be some incremental benefit to every single user of Flipboard when someone new starts using it to read content. There's a little bit of that already because we, you know, we look at sort of aggregated, anonymized, you know, reading stats, you know, what gets liked, what gets shared, you know, what articles do people get to the end of, and use that to inform, like, when we bubble up sort of editorial suggestions, things for you to read. But I think there's so much more that we could be doing there.
Yeah, I think that's a rich field that is pretty nascent these days. I don't think we have a framework of sort of really how to interpret these kind of inputs.
Yeah.
And just like either technologically or even just editorially.
Yeah, like, socially, yeah. I mean, and like you said, if it's too good, or maybe Guy was saying it, that if it's too good and if it's too predictable, then you end up in a bubble and it has to be a little bit random. And you the algorithm can't be too perfect and there has to be... Throw a little bit of noise in there just to mix things up. I mean, it's why people like products like StumbleUpon. You know,
it's got to increase your circle and not contract it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Yeah.
So switching gears with an awesome segue. speaking of not perfect enough and, you know, noisy.
Yeah.
How's running a company working for you?
It is...
You've come up in a design and engineering background, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The totally. Company is a very different thing to be doing.
Yep.
You're doing well. Are you crazy? Can I buy you a drink?
You know, it's a constant balancing act between all these things that ought to be priority number one, and you've got to say at any given moment, you know, what is my number one priority, and what is the best way for me to be spending my time. For me personally, I mean, I love coding. I really enjoy coding. I think I'm pretty good at it. I'm not the best in the world at it. It's something that I like to do. The problem with that is that I sometimes, you know, I'll find myself like hacking away on something that isn't the most important thing in the world for Flipboard because it feels good. And meanwhile, there's someone who's like tapping me on the shoulder, wants to talk about some aspect of the product design or needs a code review. And at those moments, if I feel myself like being like, oh, just give me one more minute, I got to finish my coding. That's an impulse that I've been trying to moderate.
You mentioned earlier that you'd handed over, you've gotten a lead for the iOS team.
Yeah, exactly.
And imagine one for Android too. Was that a difficult thing for you to step away from?
I think anyone who's accustomed to being an individual contributor, I mean, at Apple the whole time, I was never managing anyone at Apple. Delegation is a hard thing. Michael Lopp, Rands. He recently blogged about, and he said something to me along similar lines that was, delegation only matters when it's hard to do. If you're delegating shit work, then that's not really delegation. That's, I don't know what it is. It's, you know, subcontracting. but it's only delegation when it's something that you know that you could do, that you want to do, that you think you could probably do better than just about anyone else. But you know that you need to hand it off because there simply aren't enough hours in the day for you to do all of those things. So that's been a good,
Do you miss it though? Because I know, like, now that I have more writers working for me, I have way less time to write, and that to me always just feels insane.
Yeah,
I know I have to do it, but I want to write.
I know it's so hard. I do think. I mean, there are some people who would say, you know, you shouldn't allow yourself to write any code. I'm not quite at that point yet. I still, when it's something fun or it's something experimental, I mean, just a couple days ago.
Yeah, you need a bug to ship, you're the guy.
back on Monday, I mean, the whole office was on vacation and I snuck into the office. I took a vacation from my vacation. I wrote a little bit of code in a quiet, it was just completely
silent.
No one
could see you.
I had my little cup of tea and that was really fun, and it was something that I wrote some code that was not necessarily something that was on the product roadmap, but it was something that was kind of experimental, like that I could show to the rest of the team and use it to spur discussion. And that's the sort of code that I think it is valuable for me to still be writing. Yeah. But if I'm like, what I've tried to do is on any given major product release, if I'm the primary coder on a significant like user visible feature, that's a problem. Someone else, someone else should be getting the glory of that. Someone else should be getting the experience and the learning that comes with that. And I should be focusing on other things.
No, I think that's a great way of thinking about it.
That doesn't mean
like
it's easy.
Now I feel selfish.
No. I mean, managers can sketch out UI or even process on a whiteboard. If you can sit down and knock out like a rough prototype, that's worth having discussion about. It's like, hey, look how this works. Let's talk about that. And then somebody else can go away and actually do it right, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So it's a constant balancing act. I mean, the hardest thing about going back to your original question about starting a company is that the natural state of any startup is that you've got more good ideas than time to do them and resources, right? So you've got to be leaving good ideas on the floor constantly. Mm-hmm. And you contrast that with a company, you know, any big company, think about Google and people with 20% time. It's like, you know, and they've just got all this sort of extra bandwidth to take on all these sort of non-essential problems, which sometimes great things come of that, right? But I think what's great and what's, you know, magical about doing a startup is that, and what gives us a shot at competing with the big companies of the world is that because we can't say yes to everything, we really have to choose where to place our bets, and we have to we end up feeling really invested in them. And if we, you know, if Google comes out with some product that, you know, tanks, it's no biggie. And if we come out with something that tanks, if it tanks hard enough, you know, then our entire team is out looking for new jobs, or, you know, it's there's more, I think, at stake, and that, which is stressful. But also, once you've experienced that, I would have a hard time going back to the the big, you know, the feeling of safety that you get at a larger place.
Given that opening, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but what do you think about when a big company like Google puts out a product like Currents, for example, which clearly has inspiration, but maybe not as much passion behind it?
You know, I will admit there's a little bit of just sheer terror, like, oh, crap, you know, like they're this giant carnivorous animal that has finally, like, that realizes that you're, like, creeping around outside its cave, and they're going to come out and just, like, chew you up. But, I mean, really, the thing that we say as sort of a coping tactic for that, and I think it's true, is that it's validation that we're doing something important. Whether it's a big company or a small company, I mean, we think about products like, you know, Pulse, which, you know, got bought by LinkedIn, or Zeit, or whoever, you know, if we see those guys walking around on the street, we're like, shit, you know, these people care about the same problems that we care about. They're like kindred spirits, who, you know, how cool is that, that we both think the same problems are worth solving, and, you know, and everyone else is off, you know, doing other stuff.
It's what you think while you're mugging them, right?
No, I mean, and as far as like the Googles and the Yahoos, I mean,
well, Currents has already become Google News. I think it's now Google Play Newsstand.
Yeah. I mean, Yahoo Live, what was it, Live Stand? AOL came out with something. We really just see that as validation that we're doing something worth doing. You know, the bigger problem would be if nobody was competing with you. You'd have to ask yourself whether you were doing anything interesting.
Yeah, no, I think you guys really did carve out sort of a new way of, I don't want to say reading because it sounds too grandiose, but, you know, you did what you set out to do. You've got a personalized magazine.
Yeah.
I think it works great. And I think people have taken notice.
Yeah.
People are going to, you know, the world's first magazine, guess what? There's like a million magazines now. So,
right. But yeah, you know, but it's like I said before, it's something that we, if we think that we've solved the problem, if we trick ourselves into thinking that we've cracked the nut, that's our biggest danger. You know, getting complacency there's no room for that.
Right. So one, we're going long, but we have to do. One last thing I wanted to ask you about was the company name is the same as the product name.
Mm-hmm.
Would you ever consider doing other products? Is there anything, like, maybe there's different avenues to explore that sort of meet the, what are the company goals as opposed to the product goals? And is there any different?
I mean, we like to, I think that we, that's a really good question. Right now, we believe that the company goals and the product goals should be
totally aligned.
Be totally aligned. Now, that being said, you know, as much as there is one Flipboard product, you know, that Flipboard product exists on a bunch of different platforms. There is a limited existence of Flipboard on the web. There's a version of Flipboard for Windows, and, you know, and there isn't perfect feature and functionality parity.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you're limited. Like,
No.
I'm not saying you don't have a broad and you know, sort of very large business to run in just the Flipboard product.
No, yeah, Adobe
isn't called Photoshop, right?
That's true. Yep. Yeah. But you think about, you know, Facebook or Twitter. I mean, Facebook is Facebook, right?
Fair enough.
But I mean, Facebook has, you know, and actually Twitter does to a more limited extent. You know, they've been able to do some experimentation through
hashtag music.
Hashtag music. Say what you want about it, but it's a way for them to do something outside the sphere of what Twitter is.
Vine to some extent.
Vine to some extent, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, Facebook Camera, Facebook Poke,
Messenger, Google Plus, Google Maps, Google Calendar.
Sure.
Flipboard Poke. I'd give you $9.99 for that right now.
I think there is what it can get you is the ability to do some experimentation. You know, to do things that you don't think you're allowed to do within the confines of the core product. One thing that has been really interesting to see Twitter doing. You see, I don't know if you guys follow on Twitter. There's these accounts, Magic Rex. Do you follow Magic Rex on Twitter?
No.
It's this Twitter account, Magic, and then
R-E-C-S.
And when you follow this account, it'll send you direct messages from time to time saying, "Hey, you should follow this person." A bunch of your friends just started following, you know, this interesting person, and it's a way for them to sort of experiment with new angles. You know, and they have other secret sort of experimental account, not secret, but experimental accounts like this for breaking news and for...
I did not know that was a Twitter account. I mean, I knew it was a Twitter account. I didn't know it was Twitter owned.
I've been getting those through like notifications on my phone from the Twitter app, which I never use, but it still gives me notes because I'm an idiot. But,
So you do have to have room for experimentation that, you know, a safe place for that. For us, you know,
You're still excited about the core mission statement, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely don't. I mean, and there is sort of, especially as far as app stores go, you know, there is that sort of hit-driven mentality. I mean, you know, there is. It's very telling that the app store and the iTunes music store sort of have the same vibe in terms of like what the weekly new releases, and it's not like Beyonce comes out with an album and then 6 months later she comes out with an improved version of the same album, you know, but we sort of look at those through the same lenses on the app store and the music store. So it can be hard sometimes to be like, hey, we've just got the app and we're just working on the app and it's, or, you know, the single core product. It's right now, our answer to that is we are focused on the singular sort of core Flipboard product and the company and the product should be more or less indistinguishable. But as time goes by, I mean, I think that there is, I mean, again, going back to Facebook and Twitter, like you don't think of Twitter as an app. You think of Twitter as a service that has a lot of different tentacles and you can reach it in a lot of different ways. Eventually, I think that should be what Flipboard is. You know, whatever device you're on, whatever, you know, channel you want to access it through, you should be able to get to it. And it should be giving you that definitive, like, here's what's important to you that we've help to filter out from all the noise.
So in that respect, do you find maybe your sources like Twitter or Facebook, are they competitors in a way?
Sort of depends which side of the bed you wake up on.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Twitter and Facebook and many other, I mean, Apple, Google, I mean, we partners with all of them, right? And the content publishers and stuff. I mean, we're have all been really great, great partners who we don't want that to change. We think that they should look at us and see, hey, you know, Flipboard is bringing something unique and valuable to our, you know, pardon the word, but ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. It's not a bad word.
So, and yet, you know, with all those, there is some degree of competition, which can be larger or smaller, depending on who it is.
Right.
You know, the question that we've just got to answer with all those is like, are we adding to their, you know, are we contributing to them? Are they contributing to us?
It's that Google co-opetition word.
Co-opetition, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I hate that word.
Do you hate it more or less than...
I like the notion. I hate the word. That's just not a word.
Or less than ecosystem or phablet?
Ecosystem's a great word. That's how we have life. Co-opetition is not a word.
Disappointment is also not a word.
Just stop talking. I think that's a very healthy way to look at things. If you're not adding to the I don't want to say value proposition, but if you're not adding value to anything, then don't be a company.
It's a virtuous cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there are some companies that dig black rocks and tarry liquid out of the ground, and they extract value from the world. And there are other companies that create value in some way. I mean, they can create value by publishing and writing and photographing original content. They can create value by making people happy in some way, and what we've constantly got to be asking ourselves, especially as far as our relationships with content creators and publishers go, like, are we helping them to succeed? I mean, if we're not helping content creators to get paid ultimately, then we're just part of the problem. And we can't be this sort of neutral third party that's just like, oh yeah, we let people view your content, but we don't really care about where it comes from or how you get paid for making it. Because ultimately the New York Times has got to send, you know, the investigative journalist to Syria to nose around, and they've, you know, National Geographic has to fly the photographer to Antarctica to take a picture of the penguins. And I mean, which is why, you know, the advertising piece of Flipboard we think is so important and should be so core to the product, because great content has to come from somewhere.
I told this before the show, but we've just seen Flipboard referrals increase and increase. And our readers voted Flipboard the best overall iOS app of the year. And, you know, it's not your first year out. So I thought that to me shows that both ends are working really well.
Yeah, I was really happy to see that. You know, we think back to, you know, Apple, I think it was in 2010 or 2011. I don't remember exactly. Yep. They named us the app of the year for the iPad. And there was this funny moment about a year later. We were having a discussion with Apple, and one of the folks on our team said to them, "So what do we have to do to be app of the year this year too?" And Apple they kind of grinned and were like, "Seriously? Like you guys are just you just got it last year, right?" But I mean, that really is our goal. I mean, you know, again, going back to the whole, you know, hit driven culture of the App Store. I mean, we think that there's a lot of value in doing one thing, or, you know, pursuing one goal and one mission for a long time and going really deep on it. We just think it's a problem worth, you know, falling in love with. So
that's inspiring.
Yeah. Damn right.
And probably a good spot to stop talking. Otherwise, right. I'm gonna ask. You know, I'll end up asking a dumb question and just ruin the mood. Evan, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you guys too. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, hopefully we'll meet up next time I'm out there in the wild west.
Yeah, please drop me a line. I would have loved to come to Singleton this year. I got the note from Luke about it. I sort of have to limit my conference attendance to, I try to do like one or maybe two a year. And I think I had already expended my quota, but I would love to come next year.
Let me know. I know a guy that knows a guy that maybe fix
no names.
Okay. Where do we find you? Flipboard.com.
Flipboard.com. You can follow at Flipboard on Twitter or whatever other social, you know, place you like to do social things on. We're there.
And you're at eDog?
I'm at eDog1203, which, explaining where the 1203 comes from,
just gonna
would
ask
take
you
too much time. It's a stupid joke from high school that no one would actually find funny if I...
Leave them some mystery. It's nice to have the mystery.
March of 2012. That's what it is. Good enough.
Nope.
it's 1203-bit encryption is what it is.
You know, really, the answer is so stupid. I'm going to leave. It's better for there to be an air of mystery about it.
Yeah.
I recently found that Evan_Dahl on Twitter is a high schooler who it's totally.
So we're gonna beat him up and steal his username.
It's a she.
Oh, and,
yeah. So that's
why take us.
If you want to have just some variety in your Twitter stream, follow both eDog12 and Evan_Dahl.
I like that. Yeah. Perfect. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.